You are listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
I want it to be a duet, like an equal duet. And I don't even know if that's possible because I don't know what nature wants or what the tree wants or what the tree wants to hear. But I think it's valuable to try.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we, today, experience our surroundings. I am your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard today's guest, Cheryl E. Leonard, talking the philosophy behind her compositions using both sounds and instruments drawn from the natural world. More from Cheryl very soon. The music you hear is Meltwater, from Cheryl's album Antarctica, Music from the Ice, available through Other Minds Records on Bandcamp. Please take a moment to subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast as well as my newsletters of related topics and works in progress. Or like and subscribe on your own podcast platform. And whatever you do, tell a friend about Uncanny Landscapes, maybe a few. Cheryl E. Leonard is a musician, sound artist, and composer who lives in Northern California but works all over the world, at least partially in pursuit of that elusive duet. How do we play music not just in an environment, but with it? Beyond the resonance and reverberation, truly with the skin and the bones of a place. In this pursuit, Cheryl has concocted a unique way of composing and performing, a combination of field recordings and performances on instruments made from the place itself. Her album Antarctica, Music from the Ice, came to critical acclaim for these methods, and I can attest to the power of her live performances, in which bones, stones, wood, and more is bowed or plucked or struck to make any room echo with a far-off place. I spoke to Cheryl several weeks ago in early autumn. Now she has a new album out called Littoral, which you'll hear from after our interview. It's available from the Rural Situationism label. And now, talking about how she came to play limpet spine shells instead of, say, the oboe, here's Cheryl E. Leonard.
Yes, I had no idea I would end up doing this. I started out as a child just playing, you know, normal music on normal instruments. I studied piano starting in second grade. Then I played in high school marching band. I played the flute and then the mallets. Then I decided I wanted to be a rock star, so I bought an electric guitar and I played that for a while. Then I went to college and I learned about experimental music. I guess I should say I grew up in rural Wisconsin, so I was not exposed to very much alternative music in that location. And I went to college and learned about like Stravinsky and John Cage. I was like, whoa.
And was your
mind blown?
Did you go to university specifically looking at music or playing or listening?
Yes, yes. My goal when I set off to college was to get a degree in composition and to write a rock opera, which I did not do because my mind was blown and I learned about all kinds of new things. But it was funny. That literally was like what I wanted to do when I set off.
And was there a thing, you mentioned Stravinsky, for example, or Cage, was there something that, you know, that was the first sort of mind expanding, we can do a lot more than, you know, Tommy moment.
I was never into Tommy, but yeah. Anyway, yeah, actually, I mean, I had a professor who was very, very fond of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, you know, now it's a classic. And that was mind blowing for me at first. I was like, wow, I love the dissonance and the rhythms and, you know, not a lot of extended techniques, but some. So anyway, my conception of music got expanded greatly. when I went to undergraduate college, and I was still studying music, but I ended up writing more like, you know, 20th century classical, whatever, music. At the same time, I was playing in like indie rock bands as a guitarist.
By that point, is that in San Francisco?
No, I went to college at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Oh, right.
So I grew up in Wisconsin, and I was like, this has been a good place to grow up, but I got to get to a coast. Yeah, so I did that. And then after I graduated, I moved to San Francisco, and I still played in indie bands. I worked some horrible jobs. Then I decided to go to graduate school at Mills College, which had a wonderful experimental music program. And again, mind blown in other ways. And while I was at Mills, I also became involved with the noise scene in San Francisco. So I played in some noise bands, and we were playing junk from the street. And then at Mills, we were playing like extended techniques, junk from the street, performance art, anything, field recordings, anything can be music. So that all was happening. And at the same time, I started to get back into like hiking and outdoor stuff. It's such a bad pun, but it was just a natural evolution, right? The weird sounds, the being out in nature, the hiking, backpacking, mountaineering, climbing. You walk on a trail, you kick a rock, you're like, oh, that's a really good sound. I should use that in peace. Or maybe I need to take this rock back with me and play it in the studio.
Think of the noise scene as being, you know, Brooklyn alleys, and but if you come from a sort of rural outdoorsy background, actually what you're talking about makes an incredible amount of sense. You're not coming from banging on garbage cans, you're coming from banging on, you know, stones in the pond. And so I wonder,
but I didn't do that as a child. I didn't play stones in the pond.
Okay.
I didn't think to do it until later on, after I'd been playing junk from the street.
Yeah. And but was there an aspect to this that was an interest that triangulated that with the idea of the sound and the music and the idea of the natural world, for want of a better word at the moment, and with a sense of place? Like, there must be a point where trying to play a place kind of comes into it.
Yeah, so I think that's just me wanting to combine the great loves of my life, which are exploring the outdoors and music. And I also do martial arts, and I think that sneaks in there somehow. I love music. I wanted to keep playing music. I wanted to explore sound, but I love being outside, and I love being away from people and hearing the unusual sounds and hiking to the top of the mountain. And I don't know, I'm a person who likes to combine things and see connections. And it just made sense to me to make music about the places that I loved.
So what would have been the first piece that you made in that kind of philosophy? I mean, where, you know, not necessarily that I've heard it or something, but, you know, where was it about, so to speak? And what might it have been?
Yeah, I think the first piece that really kind of I was getting into this was called Instruments in Trees. And it was not about a specific site, per se, but it was about trees and the forest, not a specific forest. And on a whim, I wrote this proposal for a performance, and I said, I'm gonna write a piece for tree materials and string quartet. And I didn't really know what I'd do, but then the proposal was accepted, and I was like, okay, I gotta write a piece for string quartet and tree materials. So I invited some friends to come over, and we just started experimenting and improvising on the tree parts. And I went out to the park and wherever I was hiking and brought back like sticks and pine cones and bark, and we would just like play in the studio. And from there I started to develop a piece. And in the end, there was almost no string quartet, and it was mostly tree materials because I fell in love so much with the sounds that we found.
And the string quartet is tree materials as well in its own way, isn't
it? Yeah, so that made sense in my brain. You know, it's a highly cultivated tree materials.
Yeah.
Right. The initial idea came from I was just doing some improv in the forest with a friend of mine, John Blue. And I was playing viola and he was playing cello, and we were in the woods and we're just making weird sounds. And then we started bowing things in the woods. Nobody said anything, it just happened. And then we just went for it. You know, we were bowing everything we could find, and some of it sounded good, some of it was horrible.
And to this day, you still bow things.
I still play tree materials, yes.
There's a sort of this joint practice at play here that you've just kind of mentioned, recording the sounds of a place, like doing, making field recordings of a place is a practice, and building, you know, I don't know if you would even say this, but what I would call building instruments or extracting instruments. In fact, that's quite a nice way to put it, isn't it? Extracting instruments from a location.
Extracting. It sounds very clinical, though.
It does. It sounds like a fossil fuel, doesn't it? So I'll come up with a better way.
Yeah, maybe not extracting.
But
it's like, I think of it as borrowing.
Borrowing. That's great. That's even
borrowing.
Better. Borrowing instruments out of a place. So there's these two practices: field recording. In other words, you know, placing microphones in various ways in a location and getting the sound that occurs in that place, and this borrowing instruments from that place. They seem like they could be two philosophically disparate practices. Can you think out loud for me about combining those two practices, which in the one case is ostensibly, though we know not really, but ostensibly documentary, and in the other case is very much compositional? I've read somewhere that you said you mostly use your field recordings in extant, you don't modify them or play with them essentially at all. And philosophically, I see two completely different sides of the coin there.
Yes, it's a good question. It's a good block of questions. They're both a practice of listening and having a relationship with place and environment and ecosystems. So the field recording is a truck going by, sorry. The field recording is more about, for me, being still in a place and taking in what that place is, trying to understand the place. And then the natural objects, I do like to collect things. Like, I'm a person who will, like, I like to put a stone in my pocket, or I'll pick up the backpack and find like three rocks in there from a hike 2 months ago. or a leaf that I thought was particularly beautiful. So I have this collection hobby. So I like to take like a small piece of the place home with me when it's possible, when it's legal, when it's permitted, like trying not to break the laws too much. So it's almost like a little totem or something of the place. And then there's lots of things going on here. And then I like to play the found objects, right? So if I can play a piece of the place, and with that piece of the place, also be searching for a voice from the place. There's that going on. And then the way that I play the natural objects, I like them to blend in with the field recordings. Sometimes they're contrasting, but usually I like them to blend in or emerge out of the field recording so that the listener maybe doesn't know what is field recording and what was the played object. So there's this kind of blurring of these two realms. And maybe what I'm trying to do in that is to figure out how I can fit in these places. Like, what is my relationship to this place, or how can humans be part of this ecosystem in a harmonious way? It's a very loaded musical term, but or sort of resynchronize with what the environment is, what the ecosystem is. And I realized, you know, I'm a composer, I'm making decisions, you know, like I'm placing things, you know, I'm asserting my ego on the place by making a composition. So this is very Zen Cohen-like, like, you know, there's a conflict in my desires. Yeah, and I'm just, I think maybe making the music is a way to sort through that. I want it to be a duet, like an equal duet. And I don't even know if that's possible because I don't know what nature wants or what the tree wants or what the tree wants to hear. But I think it's valuable to try. Let me throw in the martial arts thing here, because I don't often talk about that in my musical practice, but I think it is important. So I have 20 something years of training in Aikido, and I'm also an instructor now. And Aikido is a martial art where you blend with the attack. So instead of trying to destroy the attacker, you try to harmonize with the attacker and then lead the attack into an outcome where no one is injured. Not me, not the attacker. And I'm very much trying to do the same kind of thing in the music. Again, I don't know, all these things in my life just converged and here I am, and there's just this, trying to resynchronize, reharmonize thing going on.
When you talk about playing these pieces, can you just describe one or two instruments, describe what they are and how you get a sound out of them?
Sure, I'll just describe a couple of my favorite instruments. How's that? So a few of my favorite natural object instruments are, number one, this is not really a hierarchy, the kelp flute. So I have these pieces of dried bullwhip kelp, which is a seaweed. And I find them on the beach in Northern California and already dried out, and they're hollow inside. And one day I picked one up and I was thinking about using it as part of a sculpture. And I looked at it. And I used to play the flute in high school, marching band. And I looked at it and I thought, this could be a flute. So So I took out my pocket knife and I carved a hole in it and I tried playing it and I was like, oh my gosh, it totally works. It's the most magical sound to me. It sounds like a ultra bass shakuhachi or something. So I'm just playing it like a transverse flute and I'm not bothering to punch finger holes in it. I'm just playing it as is, just with a little hole to blow through. And sometimes I stop the far end. So another favorite instrument is musical rocks. So I have a collection of musical rocks from different places. And these are rocks that have pitches to them. So I can have a set of these rocks. They're usually like slabs or bars of a fairly dense and rock, so it resonates. And I can make a little scale. I don't usually make a typical Western scale, but whatever scale the rocks want to have that day from that place. And I play the rocks in a lot of different ways. So everyone goes, oh, you hit them, right? Like, yeah, I could, but there's more subtle things you can do. So I like to draw on them with different kinds of materials, either another rock or a paintbrush or a feather, or drop things on them, like you could drop sand or little shells on them.
And the sound that you get from that in a live performance setting must be extraordinarily quiet until it's amplified. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, if you're playing the rock with a feather, yes. If you're dropping stones on the rock, maybe not. It might be kind of loud. Or not loud, but
for the audible. most part, when you perform live, you're miking each of these instruments. Is that sound safe to say?
Yes. Most of these instruments are pretty quiet and do need to be amplified to be heard live or even recorded properly. One more instrument is I made this instrument from my trip to Antarctica, and it's a set of 10 limpet shells that are mounted in driftwood. And each shell has a pitch. And so I can bow them, or again, I can tap them or brush them with different kinds of objects. And I have a scale of pitches there to play with. And a bowed shell, if you've never heard one, gives a very like pretty pure high tone, similar to a sine wave almost, or a flute.
So the instruments you're playing are pitched, and you're...
Some of them are pitched.
But yeah, you don't have
that
much...
Those examples are pitched.
You don't have that much control over the pitch, usually, right? So the pieces...
No, I do.
Oh, yeah?
I do have control over the pitch. Well, I mean, if I'm playing a set of rocks, I pick a set of rocks with pitches that I like together.
Okay.
Or the shells. Same thing with the shells. But I do have instruments that are not pitched, right? Another favorite is just the bowl of sand, the amplified bowl of sand. It's just beach sand with one or more hydrophones in the sand. And then anything that you do in the sand is amplified. So that's kind of fun because you can draw or press or put objects in the sand. And it really translates your gestures into sound. The same thing with a viola, but in a visceral way. Like I can literally draw on the sand and you'll hear the shape of that shape.
You mentioned Antarctica, and you've made this series of recordings of, isn't the right word?
With
Antarctica? I like with.
With is cool.
You've made an album with, you've made a collaborative album with Antarctica. I was reading this quote, an academic saying that unlike so much of the Western world, in Antarctica, to artists in Antarctica, primacy there is of sound over sight, the ear ever attuned to the cracking of ice. But maybe you can talk a little bit about how that project came to be.
Yes. So it took me 14 years to make this album, to finish the album. Still a really long time. Hopefully the next one will be quicker. I first was interested in going to Antarctica when I was finishing graduate school. And at that time, I was getting into mountaineering and going out to more remote wildernesses, and Antarctica in many ways is almost, it's like the ultimate wilderness for me. I mean, we also have the deep sea. We don't really know very much about that, and outer space, but those two things in Antarctica are like our most wild places left. So of course I wanted to go there because it's like in my brain, it was like the ultimate wilderness. And I became aware of this program from the National Science Foundation here in the United States called the Antarctic Artists and Writers Program, where they sent a handful of artists down to the continent to make work about it and the science that happens there. So I looked up the, you know, the application details, and I was like, oh, they'll never pick me. I'm way too like unestablished. So I put that thought away and I did a bunch of other stuff. And like 15 years later, a fellow Bay Area musician, Henry Kaiser, went down on this program and made music on the guitar about Antarctica. And Henry is also a research diver. So he went diving in Antarctica and then made music about Antarctica, which is great. So Henry went and then he came back and I heard about that and I was reminded of the program. And people said to me, oh, you know, Henry went to Antarctica, like you should think about applying. That'll be a good fit for your work. And I thought about it again and I was like, oh yeah, I actually have a resume now. Like maybe I'd have a shot. So I applied and miraculously I was selected. And my project in Antarctica was to make a set of compositions combining field recordings and sounds played on natural objects about the environments and ecosystems of the Antarctic Peninsula, with connections to the kinds of research happening in that specific site, which was the Palmer Research Station. So I spent 5 weeks at Palmer Station and I went out every day and made field recordings of whatever interesting sounds I could find. Lots of ice. So the glacier, the ice floating in the ocean, penguins, of course. A favorite sound is penguin footsteps. So the penguins were nesting on this island that had really resonant rocks. So when they would walk across the rocks, you'd hear like tink, 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 tink. I love that they have a musical island to nest on. So penguins, seals, I tried to record. There were many different kinds of seals there, but the only ones that I actually got sounds from were the southern elephant seals, and I kind of fell in love with them, which is funny because they're really a sub-Antarctic species, and so the fact that there are more and more of them on that site on the peninsula is really an indicator of how the climate is changing there, where these more sub-Antarctic species are really flourishing, and some of the Antarctic species are struggling in that area. And then I collected with a permit, because normally you are not allowed to remove things from Antarctica. I collected penguin bones, rocks, and limpet shells. which I brought back home and then made some of those into sculptural instruments.
What's an instrument that comes out of penguin bones?
I might be the only person who has penguin bone instruments so far. I don't know.
Yeah. Wait till everybody hears this podcast. They're going to be running down there and getting penguin bones.
No, you're not allowed to take them. You need a special permit. Do not take things from Antarctica. It's a protected continent. So one of my instruments with the penguin bones has a poetic name. It's called the Last Flight of the Adelies. So the Adelie penguins are the little classic, like, tuxedo-looking penguin. They're one of two truly Antarctic penguin species. The other is the emperor penguin. So the Adelie penguins, around the periphery of their nesting sites, you could find bones from dead penguins. So I didn't kill any penguins. I just took bones that were there. Definitely don't want to kill any of them. They're having a tough time in the Antarctic Peninsula, the northern parts, because of climate change. So that species of penguin is going locally extinct, and the sub-Antarctic species are moving into that area. So I made this instrument with penguin vertebrae, Adelie penguin vertebrae. And what I liked about the vertebrae visually is that from different angles, they looked like spaceships or flying birds. So I mounted them in driftwood and pieces of dried kelp that were curly. And so they're on the end of these curly pieces of kelp. And to me, it looks like they're in a little flying formation. And the kelp swirls are like their flight paths. So I was imagining the penguins flying, which they only fly underwater, really. And it's the last flight of the Adelies because they're going locally extinct. And then that instrument is played primarily by bowing. So bowing the vertebrae and bowing the pieces of kelp.
I just wanted to ask, while we're going, what...
They're played in Ablation Zone.
Okay.
That piece.
Great.
That instrument is in that piece. I was in Antarctica for 5 weeks, which in some ways is a long time, in some ways is a super short time. And I didn't do any composing there because I just wanted to be out in the place and experience the place and collect the materials. So I came home and I had all these field recordings and a box full of objects. And then I had to start thinking about actually making music with these things. So I listened back to all the field recordings and I made notes. Okay, this part's good. This part's got an interesting rhythm. Here are the elephant seals are like very beautiful, you know, 3 stars. I have a little log of all the field recordings. So I'm starting to think about what parts of what field recordings could become a foundation for a composition. And at the same time, I have the box full of objects and I do little mad scientist experiments in my studio. So I'm like, I got this limpet shell. So what if I like pour sand on it? Does that sound good? You know, I already knew I could bow them. So I I just try different playing techniques and I make notes. Oh, if I, you know, bow this one this way, it sounds really good. And I'm starting to realize that I need to mount some of the objects to make them easier to play, right? Like I can play one limpet shell by holding it in my hand and bowing it. But if I have a set all mounted, then it's easy to go between pitches and not set the shell down, pick another one up. Oh, here we go. Here's a new pitch. Very slow. So I'm kind of figuring out what my musical vocabulary is, what the voices of the different instruments and objects are. And when I realize I need to build something in order to play the bones better or the shells more easily, then there's a little construction going on, a little woodworking. And at the same time, I'm thinking about what sounds from the instruments could fit with which field recordings and what are these pieces about thematically, right? I wanted them to be about aspects of the site and about climate change and scientific research there. So each piece has a connection to how the Antarctic Peninsula is changing. There's a piece about wind and storm patterns. There's pieces about, you know, melting ice, melting glaciers, about the Adélie penguins going locally extinct. There's a piece, the last piece on the album was the first piece I made, the lullaby for e-seals. Because I really just, I fell in love with those guys. They're smelly, they're snorty. They have these beautiful big eyes, big dark eyes, and I love their sounds. But they're not a true Antarctic species. So how funny, I went to Antarctica and really one of my favorite things there was a sub-Antarctic animal.
Yeah, and well, my
that in itself is a story of climate change, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I realize through experience that the ideas you go into a project or a site with are not necessarily the ones you're going to come out with, and you have to be ready to let go of those initial ideas.
Right.
Yeah, you have to listen to what the place is giving you.
So it really is a duet, because you go into it
thinking, I hope so.
And then you come out of it like having been changed by what's available, by what it wants to say.
Yeah, I mean, I've almost stopped having trying not to have preconceived ideas about projects anymore. I have like loose concepts, and then I have to go in and see what's there, and then you follow that and you arrive at some music, hopefully. Yeah, so I have my whole like individual practice. And then I also, you know, I am also an improviser and performer, and I do play with other people sometimes. I, you know, over time, I've played with different groups. I've played with Big City Orchestra a bunch in the past. I still currently play with this group called Thomas Carnacki. I play in a trio called Euphotic with Brian Day and Tom Dill. And then I have this album that just came out with John Lydecker, aka Wobbly, of Negative Land, and he also plays in the Thurston Moore group. And he has this whole like solo practice as well. So what's fun about playing with other people is, as we've discussed, my solo practice, I have like almost these like kind of rules or strategies or ways that I make music. And when I play with other people, I let a lot of that stuff go, right? So I might play other things, not just natural objects, or the piece doesn't have to be about a climate change issue. It could just be a piece for the joy of music or interesting sounds. So I like having that in my realm as well. Stepping out and playing with other people and getting fresh ideas from what happens in improvising in groups. So yeah, the project with John, it's funny. So two things happened to create that album. One was he has a radio show called Over the Edge, and I went and performed live on it. And some of that was just me, and some of that was him processing me live on the radio show. And then the other thing is, during the pandemic, John and I were like talking about life and being locked down. And we were like, oh, we should get together and play some music. Like, I guess we could play outside in the park. And I realized that my field recorder is a four-channel mixer as well. And I was like, oh yeah, we can just, as long as we're like battery powered, we could totally play in the park, you know? So we met in Golden Gate Park and we just improvised. I brought my objects over. He brought some electronics and some iPad and a couple of iPads, I think it was, and phones. And we just ran it through my field recorder and listened on headphones. And we had a speaker as well. And people would walk by and be like, what's going on? This weird music. So we did that. That was like great. I think it was the first time I had played with anyone since the pandemic started. So this was like this early, like early summer 2020. I was like, oh, playing with other people again. Yes. And then we did a couple of other trips, sort of musical slash hiking trips together. So we went to Marin Headlands and we didn't play our instruments. We did some field recording and we played objects in the environment. So there's these old military bunkers and we played a metal door, made really great sounds and stuff like that. Yeah. And then we did a backpacking trip in Lassen Volcanic National Park. For a couple days, socially distanced backpacking with field recording. Because again, at that time, we still didn't really know what was safe and what wasn't. So, but backpacking was like the most normal feeling thing that you could do that summer. It's like, oh, I feel like a human being again. So we made this piece, Multiple Park, the title track from those three excursions. And it's really the spectrum from an urban park to the wilderness of Lassen, right? And Marin Headlands is in between. And we had these different interactions in the site, right? We played our instruments, we played the found objects, we just did field recording. And from all of that material, we assembled together that composition. So the album has these two things, the kind of radio stuff, and then the 2020 explorations of outdoor music making stuff. I'm currently at a residency at Marin Headlands Center for the Arts in Northern California. And one of the things I'm working on here is a set of pieces about Marin Headlands, which is part of a Golden Gate National Recreation Area. So it is a national park. And I created this piece that I started during the pandemic called Unstable Material, about one site in this park, which was an area with landslides and military bunkers falling into the ocean. And while I'm here, I'm exploring other parts of the park and making field recordings and doing on-site improvisations, which will ultimately become pieces about other parts of the park, really thinking about time scales, the history of this place, sounds over time here. So I'm thinking about the geologic time, human time. There's been a lot of things here, like the Miwok Native Americans used to gather food here and hunt here. Then it was farmland, then it was a military base, then it was, now it's a national park. So it's been a lot of things to a lot of different people. And then the environment has changed a lot. So I got here and I learned that back in the old days, before people, besides the Native Americans, there were no trees here. And there's like a bunch of trees here now, and they were all planted, apparently mostly by the military. So that was like really mind blowing. I'm like, oh, these giant trees were all planted. They were not here.
That is amazing, because that's, you know, it's so the opposite of what we always imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not heavily forested, but there are areas with trees, and apparently the military planted them to help hide their buildings and structures and installations.
Right, so they're weaponized.
Well, I don't know if they were weaponized, but they were camouflage. Yeah, and then someone was telling me at one point the Boy Scouts came through, and I'm not sure when. And they were like, what this place needs is more trees, so it feels more wild. And they planted trees to make it more wild. Just like random trees. And I may have found one the other day. I found an apple tree, which was with apples on it. Just one, in like a random spot. So that was planted by someone. Maybe it was a farmer. Maybe it was the Boy Scouts. It probably wasn't the military.
You never know, man. The military needs.
I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, so I'm thinking about this place. But the important thing, I think, for me is to inspire people to think about different time scales, to think beyond just our human time. So I'm also thinking about insect time or tree time.
Oh, that's fantastic.
A lot to think about.
Insect time is a really interesting concept.
A short time, yeah.
It's a short time. Insect. Well, it's a short time individually, but it's an incredibly long time in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, species-wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my wall here right now is covered with like the geological epochs.
Excellent. Yeah. One should definitely have epochs on the wall, just as a little reminder.
Yeah, we're so small and so fleeting.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guest has been musician, sound artist, and composer Cheryl E. Leonard. For more about Cheryl and to listen to her recordings, visit her website, allwaysnorth.com. That's A-L-L, waysnorth.com. The music has been from Cheryl's album Antarctica, Music from the Ice, available on Bandcamp through Other Minds Records. Currently, I'm playing music from Cheryl's latest release, Literal. More on that in one moment. The Uncanny Landscape's title theme is by the Bellbury Poly, and the icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. Follow me on Instagram, at Old Weird Albion, and subscribe to this podcast's cousin Substack, helpfully also called Uncanny Landscapes. Finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Substack or the Uncanny Landscapes anchor page. That's uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. More installments coming soon, including interviews with writer James Canton and field recordist Jez Riley French. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack and like, rate, or share the podcast. Or just tell a like-minded friend or two. Until next time, here's music from Cheryl's brand new release, which came out in mid-December, since Cheryl and I spoke. Here's a fragment of Cheryl Leonard's Literal.